Dr. Robert Vinoy, Old Testament History, Lecture Number 21. We're looking at the chronology of the patriarchal period in our last session. We had traced down through the data that provides us with the information to establish the chronology, and had found that in doing that, there were two variables that affect the date of the patriarchal period. The first one was 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1. Where you take 480 years as literal years, or whether you take it as a schematic number in some way, it results in the difference between the early date and the late date of the Exodus. The second variable was Exodus chapter 12, verse 40, which speaks of Israel being 430 years in Egypt. But there's a textual variant there in the Septuagint where it says, quote, Israel was 430 years in Canaan and in Egypt, end quote. So then you get the question of which is the best interpretation. Is it that Israel was 430 years in Egypt, or that Israel was 215 years in Egypt and 215 years in Canaan prior to going to Egypt? That was the point of our discussion in the last hour. You have to divide it at 215 because of the patriarchal age is 130, 60, and 25. The 130 is the age of Jacob before going down to Egypt. The 60 is the 60 years of Isaac before Esau and Jacob were born. 25 years is the 25 years Abraham was in Canaan before the birth of Isaac. So it's interesting that it does divide exactly in half the 430 if you add those figures up. Now, what we were doing then was looking at evidence for the 430 years, Genesis chapter 15 and Acts chapter 7, and population increase factors. At the end of the hour, we showed evidence for 215 years, and the primary argument there is Galatians chapter 3, verse 17, which says, quote, the law that came 430 years after the promise, and the promise was to Abraham, end quote. Now, I've mentioned, I think right at the close of the hour, that one way to respond to the argument that this establishes the 215-year sojourn in Egypt and 215 in Canaan is to say that the promise was confirmed to Jacob just prior to their going down into Egypt. I gave you those references, Genesis chapter 46, verse 3, and chapter 35, verse 9. So that's one way to respond to that. But I wanted to mention just one other comment on that, and that was the suggestion of K.A. Kitchen. This is that same book that I mentioned in the last class hour, Ancient Orient and Old Testament, page 53, note 97. That's in your bibliography, the bottom of page 12. Kitchen says there, quote, Paul in Galatians 3:17 is concerned to establish one single point, that the law came long after God's covenant with Abraham. He therefore makes his point, not laboriously calculating the actual interval between these events, but simply and incisively by citing the one well-known figure for 430 years included within that interval, end quote. So what he's saying is when you read Galatians 3:17, where it says, quote, this I say, the covenant that was confirmed before God in Christ, the law which was 430 years after, cannot annul, that should make the promise of no effect, end quote. He's saying that the 430 years was the well-known block of time that everyone knew about in that larger interval. So that's Kitchen's way of interpreting the appearance of that number. It's not to be concluded that the entire span of time from Abraham to Moses was 430 years. Now he goes on and makes another statement in connection that I think is important in connection with his view, because he says, quote, that Paul made use of the Septuagint interpretation of the 430 years as a gratuitous an unnecessary assumption, where the wish of the modern commentary, perhaps too often, is the father of the thought, end quote. Kitchen is not saying that Paul is following the Septuagint. He's saying what he's doing is simply citing the one well-known period of time within the larger interval, 430 years. That's also a possible explanation. I think he is cautionary by saying that Paul is following the Septuagint, because if Paul is citing the Septuagint, and the Septuagint does say there's only 215 years in Egypt, then what do you do with all these Genesis passages? It mentions 400 years. It seems quite clear. All right, so Galatians 3:17 is, of course, the strong text in favor of the 215-year view. The Samaritan Pentateuch, as well as the Septuagint, supports that view. I've already discussed the reading of the Septuagint, which says, quote, "The sojourning of the children of Israel while they sojourned in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan was 430 years, end quote. The other line of argument that supports the 430 years is Genesis chapter 15, verse 16, and Exodus chapter 6, verses 16 through 20. Now, we've already looked at Genesis chapter 15, verse 16. You see, Genesis 15, 16 says, quote, "In the fourth generation they shall come here again," end quote. Fourth generation. Exodus chapter 6, verses 16 through 20 says, "These were the names of the sons of Levi according to their records, Gershom, Kohath, and Merari. Levi lived 137 years. The sons of Gershom, by clans, were Libni and Shimei. The sons of Kohath were Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel. Kohath lived 133 years. The sons of Merari are Mahli and Mushi. These were the clans of Levi according to their records. Amram married his father's sister Jochebed, who bore him Aaron and Moses. Amram lived 137 years, end quote. Now that's a genealogy. If you trace it out, you find the structure is this. You move in verse 16 from Levi down to Kohath, and from Kohath to Amram, and from Amram to Moses. And of course, Levi has Gershom, Kohath, and Merari as sons. Gershom has Libni and Shimei as sons, and Merari has Mahli and Mushi. Amram has his sons, Moses and Aaron. Those are the other names that are in that sequence in Exodus chapter 6, verses 16 through 20. Now the question is, do you link Genesis 14, which says four generations, with Exodus chapter 6? There are four generations, Levi, Kohath, Amram, and Moses. That would seem to fit with 215 years better than 400 years. A generation is not normally 100 years, but you see, the problem is that there are a number of problems. One of the problems is also in Genesis 15, it doesn't normally say four generations. It says 400 years, so that door there, or, quote, generation, end quote, could well be the way I explained before, a period of about 100 years. So it would be about 400 years. Now, Kitchen also discusses this matter, and he says of the statement in verse 20 that, quote, "Amram took Jochebed, his father's sister, in marriage, and she bore him Aaron and Moses," end quote. He says, quote, "The statement that Jochebed bore to Amram, Aaron, and Moses in Exodus chapter 6, verse 20, does not prove immediate descent," end quote. We're back to that same issue of language that's used in biblical genealogy. And his view is, quote, "Exodus chapter 6, verses 16 through 20 is not a full genealogy, but only gives the tribe Levi, the clan Kohath, the family group Amram by Jochebed, to which Moses and Aaron belonged," end quote. So that Amram and Jochebed are not to be understood as actual parents. It is the family group of Amram and Jochebed out of which Moses comes. Now, if that's the case, and I think Kitchen is on pretty solid ground when he suggests that, if that's the case, we don't know what names of the immediate parents of Moses were. They are not mentioned in the Exodus narrative, which earlier in the Exodus narrative, where Moses is hidden in the bulrushes and so forth, the names aren't given there. Now, there's another factor that I think pretty well confirms that this is a proper understanding, and that is the Amramites, that is, this group of descendants of Amram, are already quite numerous at the time of the Exodus. Look at Numbers chapter 3, verse 27 and 28. To Kohath belong the clans of Amramites, Izharites, Hebronites, and Uzielites. These were the Kohathite clans. End quote. See, that's all the descendants of Amram and Jochebed. Quote, the number of all the males a month old or more was 8,600. The Kohathites were responsible for the care of the sanctuary. End quote. 8,600 in the time of the Exodus, so I think you're talking more than one generation. You have to be. Although, at the same time, I want to say there are problems with these census figures, and I want to discuss that whole issue later. But it seems to me that you can't simply say Genesis chapter 15, verse 16 says four generations. Exodus 6 goes Levi, Kohath, Amram, Moses. Therefore, that fits better as four generations. And that fits better with 215 years. And use that as an argument to establish the 215. It's more complex than that. So I think all things considered, we're better to stick with the Masoretic text with 430 years. We're better to understand the Galatians passage, even in the way Kitchen does, by citing the one main figure within the larger span, or as indicating the promise to Abraham, as reconfirmed with Jacob, the law was 430 years after that. Question or comments? This is not a simple problem. There are a lot of angles to this. Well, I think the arguments for the 430 are mainly Genesis chapter 15, verse 13, chapter 15, verse 16, Acts chapter 7, verses 6 through 7, and the population increase. Okay, we were looking under the difficulties with the biblical data. First, I said it was difficult to specify this 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, 480 years thing. Secondly, 430 years, which is what we've just been discussing. Thirdly, which would really be C under 2, quote, we don't have any extra-biblical evidence to identify any of the contemporaries of Abraham mentioned in Genesis, end quote. Now, what comes into view there, and we'll discuss this a bit more later, is chapter 14 in particular, because in 14 you have that coalition of kings that comes and attacks and captures Lot. Abraham pursues them, and there are a number of kings of a number of countries mentioned in Genesis 14. If we knew from extra-biblical evidence that, quote, oh, here's so-and-so, end quote, then we could date him from, say, Mesopotamian records or something. It would help to give a link to the time of Abraham. We don't have anything like that, however. Now, Kitchen says, in a general way, that Genesis 14, with the coalition of kings, fits the political pattern in Mesopotamia for the period 2000 to 1750 BC, but not before or after. It fits the political patterns in Mesopotamia with the alliances of small city-state kings for the period 2000 to 1750 BC, but not before or after that. So, to that degree, we can say Abraham fits approximately 2000 to 1750 BC, but you can't nail it down. So the point is that the difficulty with the chronology are these two factors plus no extra-biblical evidence really doesn't help us much. Number three on your outline, here are the variables where we've already discussed, but just by way of review. The variables are two. Early slash late date of the Exodus. You have an early date for the Exodus, that's 1446 BC. if you take that late date for the Exodus, 1290 BC. The other variable is whether you follow the Masoretic text or the Septuagint on the length of Israel in Canaan and Egypt. If you follow the Masoretic text, that means that 1446 is plus 645 years. 430 plus 215 equals 645. So you simply add 645 and you get 2091 BC for the entrance of Abraham into Canaan. If you follow the Septuagint, you get 1876. That's adding just 430 from 215 years in Egypt and 215 in Canaan. But if you start with the late date of the Exodus, usually about 1290, sometimes it's 1260 or somewhere in that period, if you follow the Masoretic text tradition, plus 645 gives you 1935 BC, and the Septuagint reading gives you 1720 BC. You see, well, the range then ultimately becomes 2091 down to 1720 BC, depending on the variables you follow. That's why Schultz says at the beginning of his discussion of the chronology of the patriarchs that the thing is not 100% certain, although he favors now the earlier date, which I would also favor too. It seems to me that the weight of the evidence goes to the earlier date of the Exodus. I'll discuss that later, and the reasons for it, and for the Masoretic text reading as well. Questions and comments? Let's move ahead then to D on your outline, which is, quote, Abraham, end quote. We're discussing the patriarchal period under Abraham. Number one, quote, Abraham as a historical figure, end quote. I'm going to discuss first Abraham as a historical figure and then pick up and discuss Abraham as our spiritual father. But first, just look at Abraham as a historical figure, and a small a is, quote, general outline of his geographical movements, end quote. When we go back to Genesis chapter 11, verse 28, you read, quote, Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees, end quote. And then in verse 31, quote, Terah took Abraham his son and Lot the son of Haran, his son's son. They went from the land of the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there, end quote. So he's born in Ur of the Chaldeans. Most students of this section of Genesis understand Ur of the Chaldeans to be Ur in southern Mesopotamia, Ur that was excavated by Leon Woolley. You read about that southern Ur in Finnegan. The third dynasty of Ur dates 2070 to 1960 BC, so you see that's right about the time of Abraham. The third dynasty of Ur was that Neo-Sumerian period, which Finnegan discusses on page 39 and following. They went from Ur to Haran, and you read in Genesis chapter 11, verse 31, that, quote, they came unto Haran and dwelt there, end quote. Now Ur is down here. Move up the Euphrates, past Babylon, past Mari, up to Haran, way up there in the north. Some now find the reference to Ur of the Chaldeans to refer to a northern Ur northeast of Haran, although there is a debate on this new suggested location. In Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, the Lord tells Abraham to get out of that country from the kindred of his father's house. You read in chapter 12, verse 4, that Abraham departed out of Haran, and then in chapter 12, verse 6, quote, Abraham passed through the place of the land unto the place of Shechem, under the oak of Moreh, and the Canaanites were then in the land, end quote. So he moves from there down past Damascus into the area of Shechem in Genesis chapter 12, verse 6. In Genesis chapter 12, verse 8, it says, quote, he removed from there unto a mountain in the east of Bethel, end quote. See, Bethel and Ai are a bit south of Shechem. Quote, Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. And there he built him an altar, end quote. Then in verse 9, quote, he journeyed going toward the Negev, end quote. That is further south. And then you read in verse 10, quote, there was a famine in the land. Abraham went down into Egypt and sojourned there, end quote. So he goes all the way down into Egypt. Then in Genesis chapter 13, verse 1, Abraham went out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, Lot with him, into the Negev. Verse 3 says, he went from his journeys from the Negev to Bethel at the place of his beginning, between Bethel and Ai. And then verse 18 says, quote, Abraham moved his tents and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and he built there an altar to the Lord, end quote. So basically you have his movement from Ur of the Chaldees up to Haran, down to Egypt, back into Canaan, with a number of sites in Canaan mentioned, Shechem, Ai, Bethel, Hebron, and Mamre. Now that's quite a journey. That would be quite a journey even today with modern transportation. So Abraham was one who traveled a lot. Now B on your sheet, under, quote, Abraham as a historical figure, end quote, is Genesis chapter 14. I already made reference to that. It is rather a remarkable chapter. The first thing that we notice about it is that it is unusual because it is the only record of a military activity on the part of the patriarch. Even though Abraham, you might think, was somewhat of a nomad, he moves from Ur of the Chaldees up to Haran, down to Egypt and back. We shouldn't view him as a poor person, someone who was just on his donkey going around the trail, because he was a very rich man. That's indicated in chapter 13, verse 2, where it says, quote, Abraham was very rich in cattle, in silver, and in gold, end quote. And down in verse 6, when you get to that dispute between Abraham and Lot, we read, quote, the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, because their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together, end quote. They apparently had many herds and flocks, and he was a very rich man, probably a wealthy businessman in cattle. He had numerous servants. You read in chapter 12, verse 5, quote, Abraham took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls he had gotten in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, end quote. Quote, the souls that they had gotten in Haran, end quote, were undoubtedly servants. Apparently, he had numerous servants. You read in Genesis chapter 13, verse 7, that there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's cattle and the herdsmen of Lot's cattle. So Abraham and Lot had servants. Many of them served as shepherds, undoubtedly, but those servants could act in a military way if necessary. And that's what happened when they were attacked by this coalition of kings and Lot was kidnapped. You read in verse 14, chapter 14, quote, when Abraham had heard that his brother was taken captive, he armed his trained servants, born in his house, 318, and pursued them to Dan, end quote. So you have the number given there of 318 servants. They were apparently trained to fight, and they went out to rescue Lot. So you see Abraham from a different perspective than we normally think of him in chapter 14. The second thing about Genesis chapter 14 that is quite remarkable and different is that it gives us the names of many kings and the places they ruled and the names of the places of a number of battles. You begin the chapter with the statement, quote, at this time, Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, went to war against Bera, king of Sodom, Birsha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemember, king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. All these later kings joined forces in the valley of Sidim, the Salt Sea. For 12 years, they had been subject to Chedorlaomer, but in the 13th year, they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings allied with him went out and defeated the Rephites in Ashtaroth Karnaim, and the Zuzites in Ham, the Emites in Sheva Kiriathaim, end quote, and so forth. It's always been an interest to historians, who are these people? There has been a lot of discussion about the first man there, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and it used to be that many tried to identify him with Hammurabi. There's some slight resemblance between the name Hammurabi and Amraphel. Shinar seems to be Babylon, so it would fit in that respect. But more recent evidence for dating Hammurabi makes it, I think, unlikely. Hammurabi is pretty firmly dated now around 1700 BC. I mean 1728 to 1686 BC. So I'd say approximately 1700 BC. The way in which the dating of that has come about is from those Mari letters, where there was correspondence between Hammurabi and Zimri-Lim, the king of Mari. Hammurabi eventually defeated Zimri-Lim, but there used to be thought that Hammurabi was earlier, but now it's pretty well fixed that he's about 1700 BC. 1700 BC would be late for Abraham, unless you're going to take the late date of the Exodus. E. Spicer's Genesis Anchor Bible Commentary, he discusses Amraphel on page 107, and he says, quote, "Linguistically, there's no way to relate the names Amraphel and Hammurabi," end quote. Spicer says the final, quote, "L" in Amraphel would have to be an error for a Y for Hammurabi, the final L and the Y. The initial Aleph is a mistake for Ayin. Amraphel has an Aleph and Hammurabi an equivalent of Ayin. Aleph and Ayin don't sound a lot different to us, but in some of these languages they are quite different. So what Spicer is pointing out is that linguistically you really can't very well make a case for connecting the two names. But that means we don't know who Amraphel was because there isn't any extra biblical evidence on who he was. Again, that doesn't mean that we should be suspicious about the historical credibility of Genesis 14. I'll get back to that whole business of the fragmentary nature of archaeological findings. Genesis chapter 14 is an interesting chapter because it has all those names. Maybe someday, you know, like these Ebla finds, maybe somebody will come up with tablets with reference to these people and places that at present we don't know anything about. In the Ebla tablets, one of the initial reports was that there was a reference to five cities that were mentioned in Genesis 14. And not just five cities, but they were in precisely the same order that they were mentioned in Genesis chapter 14. That caused a fellow named David Noel Freeman, who was so struck by that, it caused him to propose that the patriarchal period ought to be pushed back to about 2300, way back earlier, to coincide with the Ebla tablets. It's kind of a radical proposal on the basis of five names being mentioned in the same order in the Ebla tablets. Those texts still haven't been published, those five names and the order of them. It was information from a lecture or something of one of these people who did have the information or access to the tablets gave. It since has been disputed by one of the other people who has access to the tablets that this fellow really had misread some of the symbols and that these cities weren't named in that same order. I forgot which ones were correct, but that whole issue at this point is something that's elusive because you can't get at that material, and it has gotten somewhat political with the Syrian government. But apparently, in the Ebla tablets, some of these cities are mentioned, Sodom, for example. Customs are circumstantial evidence, in the sense that the kinds of ideas that are reflected in the laws of Hammurabi in some instances, but more particularly in the Nuzu documents with slave adoption, marriage rights, inheritance rights, things like that seem to be very similar to the customs that we find reflected in the patriarchal narratives. But Nuzi is later, about 1400 to 1500 BC. It's later, so it's circumstantial evidence. It doesn't prove a lot, but the fact it's later is not terribly significant, I don't think, because customs like that tend to be traditional things that don't change that much over a period of 200 or 300 years or even 500 years. Chedorlaomer is the other name here that's often talked about. The interesting thing is we know that name to be really Elamite, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, because we have found similar names in Elamite texts. Not exactly this one, but Kador or Kedor, the first part of it, means, quote, servant, end quote, and Laomer, end quote, and, quote, Laomer, end quote, is the Elamite goddess, quote, Laomer, end quote. So it's really a servant of this goddess, is the meaning of the name, and it fits what is known about early Elamite texts. I wasn't planning to discuss the issue of the size 318 servants, but that is often questioned. I tend to think the thing parallels those Amarna letters, which, admittedly, are somewhat later, but those are letters from Canaanite city-state kings to the Egyptian pharaoh about 1400 BC. You have there, in some of the Amarna letters, references to troop contingencies of very small sizes, which would be very similar to this. I think I've read to you earlier that Gunkel said that it was ridiculous, or something to that effect. You can't believe that a world-conquering army of just 318 men would defeat this coalition of Mesopotamian kings. But I think what you have to do is put it in the context. There are not empires, like, say, the Egypt Empire, the Mesopotamian Empire, or later Assyria and Babylon. These were small city-state kings, and they probably came on a marauding kind of trip down through Canaan, attacking other small towns and trying to plunder it. 318 men in that kind of a context can be quite a force. But it's still a legitimate question to ask. How does this fit with what we know about military movements of that time? It's not incongruent with what we know, and it's really the people who say it is incongruent that don't understand the situation of the time with respect to the size of military troops. Now let's go on to C. B was, quote, Genesis chapter 14, end quote. C is, quote, Abraham and the Philistines, end quote. The question of Abraham and the Philistines is found in Genesis chapter 21, verse 32, where you read, quote, Thus they made a covenant at Beersheba, but then Abimelech rose up, and Phicol, the captain of his hosts, and returned into the land of the Philistines, end quote. And verse 34 says, quote, Abraham sojourned in the Philistines' lands many days, end quote. So in the conclusion of the chapter 21, you have the dispute between Abimelech and Abraham over the use of a well. You have a reference made to the Philistines. There, I would say most commentaries say, you have an anachronism. What's an anachronism? That is something incongruous in the time in which it is placed in the text. And what is said is this must be written by somebody later, who knew about the Philistines when the Philistines were a menace in the land of Canaan. But the Philistines didn't exist in the time of Abraham, so it is anachronistic. Usually the point is made that the Philistines did not arrive in Canaan until about 1200 BC, which is long after Abraham's time, about 2000 BC. Their arrival is usually associated with the attack on Egypt by the Sea Peoples that was repulsed. Usually it is thought that the Philistines came from Crete and came from the Mediterranean and attacked Egypt. Then they settled on the southern coast of the land of Canaan and became a group of people we know by the time of David and Saul. Now the critics say the story was written later. It was taken for granted at a later time that the Philistines were always there. I've brought, I think, in the last hour or the one before, John Bright's book, The History of Israel, the third edition. John Bright says on page 82 of that book that the reference to the Philistines is an anachronism. And he says, quote, although there were contacts with the Aegean lands throughout this period, the Philistines themselves arrived much later, end quote. Now, what can we say about that? It's on page 12 of the notes. There's the answer by Joseph Free, Archaeology and Bible History. In Free's book, page 65 to 66, he discusses the problem of the Philistines. Joseph Free was a professor at Wheaton College for years. He did a lot of archaeological work in Palestine. In fact, he personally bought the ground on which Tel Dothan was located. So I think he or his family or foundation or whatever owns the Dothan Tell, and he excavated there for a long period of time. Wheaton College has a lot of artifacts from Dothan. But in any case, he wrote this book, which is a good handbook on the Bible and archaeology. He says on page 65, quote, some liberals have held that this reference of Abraham having dealings with the Philistines in the year of 2000 is a mistake, since the Philistines came in about the year 1200. Burroughs of Yale said, quote, we have seen that the Philistines came in to Palestine in the early Iron Age, not far from 1200. It is quite impossible to date Abraham and Isaac as late as this. Yet the book of Genesis presents both as having dealings with the Philistines and the king Abimelech, end quote. Burroughs says that this may be explained as a convenient and harmless anachronism, and concludes, quote, at any rate, and the mistake that we have come upon is undoubtedly a mistake, end quote. Free's comment is, quote, this type of supposed contradiction is often used by liberals to support their statement that the Bible has problems and even direct contradictions in many cases, end quote. But Free says, quote, there's no actual contradiction. The whole argument is based on silence. As yet, there is inconclusive archaeological evidence that's been unearthed showing that there were Philistines in Palestine in 2000 BC. It's entirely possible, however, that they were in Palestine at this early date, and their numbers were increased by other Philistines from the Aegean by about 1200. This last influx is demonstrated by the archaeological discoveries. It is entirely possible that we shall find archaeological evidence of early Philistines in Canaan. In any event, so many other confirmations of scripture passages have been found that it is ill-advised to press an argument from silence when one insists that there could have been no Philistines in Palestine at this time, end quote. You see, that is an illustration of the very kind of thing that we talked about earlier, concluding the biblical statement as such, because it is not confirmed by archaeological evidence. Whether we will ever uncover archaeological evidence of the Philistines in 2000 BC in the southern coastal area of Canaan is an open question. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. But I think we need not feel that we have to conclude that the biblical material is suspect simply because we have not that kind of archaeological confirmation. Any questions on that? I might just say that if you go over to Exodus chapter 13, verse 17, you have the statement there that, quote, God led them at the time of the Exodus, not through the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest the people repent when they see war and return to Egypt, end quote. The implication of Exodus chapter 13, verse 17 is that the Philistines were strong in that coastal area in the time of the Exodus. Now, if you hold to an early date of the Exodus, which is around 1400 BC, you're still prior to the time when there's evidence for the Philistines in southern Canaan, which is around 1200 BC. So it's not just the problem with Abraham and Isaac, but I think our response to that should be archaeological evidence is fragmentary. It doesn't really establish the case. Well, apparently in the coastal area where the Philistines were located, they have found some evidence of occupation about 1200, but they haven't found evidence of occupation earlier than that. That could depend a lot on what kind of an occupation it was, what kind of a culture they had, and how they lived. There can be a lot of variables. They just haven't found evidence of earlier Philistine settlements there. Sometimes you don't know where to dig. See, if you have the long-term site that built up these tells, then site identification is pretty easy. But if you don't have a long-term site, who knows where they were? They could be anywhere. Okay, we'll pick that up tomorrow. This ends Dr. Robert Vinoy's Old Testament History, Lecture number 21.